I was getting mad at all the trick-or-treaters who were being all polite at my door. Like, come on, kids.
Well, instead of what?
They're coming up and they're like,
a couple rude ones.
Happy Halloween. I love the rude ones. They're like, happy Halloween. Thank you. I was like, what? You're not embracing the spirit of Halloween. Get out of here.
You love the rude ones?
The rude ones are hilarious. They come up. I don't like this kind of candy. Can I have more?
A couple of those.
I'm like, yeah, you have more. Why'd you even ask? Just stick your hand in there. Oh, brat.
I mean, the toddlers often do that. I get that. But the older ones were like,
with Kathy. I'm team Kathy on this one.
Yeah.
Punk.
Oh, man.
Say thank
you're essentially begging for candy.
I want to like have this feeling that the kids might egg my house if I don't do what they ask.
Why would you want that?
It's so Halloween. That's more Halloween to me.
Yeah,
if a kid's like, give me candy.
It's traditional Halloween for sure.
I love those kids that come around at 9 and they're high schoolers and they're not wearing a costume and they just have like a pillowcase. And they just hold it out and go, how much you got left? I'm like, yeah, you get the rest. Get out of here. Turn my light out now.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to episode 339 of The Fascinating Podcast, a show about the fascinating people and events at the heart of our cultural conversations. I'm Clay Morgan.
I'm J.R. Forasteros.
I'm Kathy Kong.
And I am special guest Matt Nicolaitis.
Welcome.
Welcome, Matt.
On this week's show.
Thank you.
Guys, we're diving into a critical topic that is already impacting our way of life. It's the case of the disappearing water. Mm. So the mystery lies in what we're supposed to do about it. Kathy, activists are putting their heads together, sometimes even with super glue. So we'll tackle this sticky subject.
Oh, man. Clay, I just want to say, Clay, before you throw it off anywhere else, I just want to say I love these like education kind of episodes where you teach us about things and are the expert, like stuff like water rights and all that. And I'm really excited for what you're going to teach us this episode.
Just to sit and soak it all in.
Well, that's exactly what we're planning on doing.
Just to learn, for sure.
I feel like a drain for me to do it myself, so I love soaking it in from you.
I can't decide which one of you I like least right now. But, every once in a while, JR comes into our private chat real hard. And
it's true.
It happened this week, and he said,
Rarely does that happen, but every now and again.
Rarely.
I mean, he came in forcefully the other day, and he said, story of the week, non-negotiable, and dropped something off for us. JR, and would you...
We even tried to negotiate, but he said no.
no negotiating. JR, would you enlighten us?
I would, and I would like to say this is going to be my only contribution this episode, because as Matt already mentioned, this is Clay's episode. So,
that's right.
I'm sure, like me, y'all are familiar with the ancient painter Hieronymus Bosch.
Mm-hmm.
Painted in the so-called Middle Ages, or around 1500. And he created a painting in 1503, 1504 called The Garden of Earthly Delights. You can Google image search it. It's a triptych. So on one side is heaven, on one side is hell, and in the middle is, like everything else. And on the hell side, there is a demon poking a man who is laying on his belly, on his own belly, not on the demon's belly. And on the man's butt, there is inscribed music, like a full staff of music and notes that are playable. And so this is not a new thing. People have known this since 1504 when the painting was first made available for public view. But if you go to YouTube and search, you can actually find all kinds of people who have transcribed and performed Hieronymus Bosch's butt music from hell. And I'm just curious.
How's it sound? Is it good?
It's fine, I guess. I mean, should it be good is maybe a better question.
I mean, how many other butt music pieces are there that you could actually compare to?
Yeah, from heaven or hell, for that matter, right? Yeah, I mean, I would say the number of total butt songs that exist in the world is, I would guess, fairly low, though I have not counted.
I mean, that isn't like, featuring butt trumpet solos, really.
That's the question. You what know, instrument I, was it written for? Like the bassoon? So
here's the beautiful thing, right? It's in the treble clef, so probably not the bassoon. Though
it says
props on the pun. Yeah.
Thank you.
So but yeah, I would assume that any instrument that is capable of playing in the treble clef.
I mean, it's gotta be a wind instrument though.
Surely. Surely you would think so, right? Yeah.
Definitely not percussion.
So anyway, we're going to check with our audio producer, Aaron, about whether he can drop some butt music in. If not, my suspicion is he will just clip this part out and you won't hear us even asking him. But if he is able to, then please enjoy this Hieronymus Bosch composed butt song from hell, courtesy Aaron Kretzmann, our audio producer, and whichever kind instrumentalist he has chosen to feature. Well, we're done with that, so I guess now we should move on to something completely different.
10 years of podcasting excellence here at the Fascinating Podcast.
We've resorted to butt music.
Okay, obviously, everyone's favorite movie is the objectively best movie ever made, Mad Max Fury Road, which, of course, references something in their distant history called the Water Wars. And it's actually beginning to seem as though perhaps...
Is that like a reference to like a big super soaker thing?
Probably, yeah. No, they ran out of water.
I don't know. Oh, they ran out of water. Oh.
Yeah, and so this is my way of bowing out of the conversation and tossing it over to our fearless leader, Clay, to tell us a little bit about his... No, seriously. Okay. I'll keep you aside. Clay, you pitched this episode when we were planning out the season.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about... Yep. So I wanted to learn about it. So the catalyst was probably, have you guys seen these news stories about Lake Mead?
Yes.
And the water levels have been sinking and they kept discovering human remains. Bodies, right? And if you're like me, it seemed like the first two or three of those stories was like guys who had been shot and stuffed in a barrel. So everybody's like, oh, we're going to find all of the mafia victims of like the 70s and 80s, right? Matt, are you familiar with these news stories?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I think that was an attention-grabbing kind of reality. But then I would click on these stories and I would read that, well, investigators are going to try to find out what they can learn. But then I would start hearing about why water levels are decreasing. And it seemed to me that this is a pretty huge deal. Like climate issues are big. I want to learn more about that. I've been trying to learn about carbon emissions and carbon footprints and those kinds of things. But here in the States, we've heard a lot of different conversations about water supplies, water shortages, right? Particularly in the Southwest and in California. You know, there's certainly apocalyptic scenarios where we literally run out of clean water and things like that. But it just seemed like an important topic. And I don't know a ton about it. But I understand that this was coming up on the midterm elections and that there's a lot of states where this is a defining issue. And so it just seemed like an interesting topic to explore. So here is kind of the kickoff statement, guys. I was doing some reading from the United Nations Environment Program. And did you know that over the last 20 years, 90% of major disasters, environmental disasters, were caused by floods, droughts, and other water-related events.
Wow, that seemed like shocking to me.
Right, that seemed like really high. So as I was,
because that would include like typhoons and hurricanes and things like that. I assume
forest fires in California, right? Like we see the fires are a big deal. So what is that related to?
Oh, it's related to drought.
Drought, yeah,
yeah. So
that was one interesting. Thing that was coming in a lot of stories. And then I heard something about how, you know, Saudi Arabia was buying up American water.
Oh, yeah.
Something you need to look out for. And so I was like, okay, that sounds like that's not the full story, but I want to understand what that means.
Yeah, it's worse than it sounds.
What do you mean?
Well, it sounds like, oh, they're buying up water rights, but they own the water rights to most of Arizona. And they're not paying the right amount. They're paying hardly anything for what they're taking.
And it's not just Arizona, and it's not just Saudi Arabia. I mean, America owns land in other countries, and China and Canada and Mexico, they own a lot of parcels here in the Southwest. And so what I found out was this actually has a lot to do with alfalfa. Mm-hmm. And apparently alfalfa is like a base product in a lot of food. And if you grow something like alfalfa and you export it, and then a country like, for example, there's a Saudi Arabian company that exports a lot of alfalfa from the American Southwest. Well, there's water that grows that and inside of that.
Yeah.
So I started learning about green water and blue water and virtual water and these kinds of topics. And so I just thought it would be something we should talk about. One, it seems important. Two, we're seeing a lot of activism around climate change. It's obviously a defining topic of our time. And three, what should a person of faith do in response to these kinds of realities? Is there anything we can do? So that's kind of where I was pondering the show today.
Wow.
Is this something that's on your radar, guys? Do you know anything about this? Is there any, yes. Is there any scientists here?
No scientists, but, you know, at some point I had decided that I was going to try and convince Peter that we would move to maybe like Arizona because I don't like the winters here. Although that may change because it's 70 degrees today, November 2nd. So climate change, thank you very much. But as we were looking into and talking with friends about moving to different climates, somebody had mentioned like, oh, well, we could look at New Mexico because, you know, we're all going to move as a group. And then we started doing some digging and there were issues around water and how there were going to be water shortages. And you already see that in the Southwest. And that's why we just need to stay here in Chicagoland because of the Great Lakes. That everybody's going to want our water, even though they don't want our weather.
But the weather's changing.
That's what I know. But the weather is changing because it's going to be 70 degrees. Actually, it is 70 degrees right now.
What?
And tomorrow. It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
So you guys are literally changing your future plans.
I mean my hypothetical future plans. Uh-huh.
I should point out, by the way, JR, it does turn out that those aren't all mafia hits being discovered in Lake Mead. A lot of it are like drowning victims and things. There's actually been some families that have at least gotten closure after some terrifying things like 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, I would assume the mafia victim families also get closure.
Yeah, but there's only like apparently one that appears to be murder, but you're correct.
Okay.
Only one.
So far.
Come on, so Lake far. Mead. So in 2009, my wife and I visited some friends who lived in Tucson, Arizona. And one of the days we were in Tucson, we went for a hike out in the surrounding wilderness. And we were walking through a valley. And my friend LaRue, who is a biologist, pointed out that what we were walking in was actually a dry riverbed. And that the population of Tucson had grown such that it literally drained the water table in Tucson dry. And it was actually becoming a serious problem. And the city was trying to figure out how to keep people from moving there. We've had similar problems in Texas. So there's actually only one natural lake in the entire state of Texas. Every other lake, and there are a lot of them, there are four that I'm thinking of off the top of my head just in the northern part of Dallas are all Army Corps of Engineer created reservoir lakes. When we first moved to Texas in 2014, they were at the end of a four-year drought. Of course, they didn't know that they were at the end of it yet. But that was we moved here in September of 2014. Beginning in February or March of 2015 and going all the way through July, it rained almost every day. And our reservoir lakes went from being anywhere between 11 and 17 feet low to overflowing and flooding. which was great, actually. It was great, yeah. Clay, I don't know if you remember the swamp in our backyard because you were living up
it. Yeah.
We were living together at that point. So, but, you know, the reality was if that had gone on much longer, there would have been a real problem of, like, how do we get enough water to enough people? I can't help but think of Jacksonville, Mississippi, right, which has been an ongoing crisis of literally no potable drinking water in the city and the National Guard having to drive in truckloads of water just to keep people alive. Like, we're not even talking about, like, bathing or cooking. We're literally talking about just being able to drink enough water to live. And this is in the biggest city in Mississippi, you know, which isn't saying a lot, but it is still a major U.S. city.
Wow.
So this is an, yeah, I think this is going to continue to get worse.
Well, it's not new is the other thing. You know, we're talking about it a lot right now, but there actually were, do you guys remember? I mean, I don't know if you, I grew up in California, so we talked about this in history class some, but the California Water Wars, are you familiar with that at all?
No.
So, a little bit, just too far so, to know much about it.
Yeah, so as Los Angeles is growing, so we're talking early 1900s, they realize being in the desert that they don't have enough water for the infrastructure. And so in 1913-ish, they went to this place called the Owens Valley, which was a farming community. And they built an aqueduct to start taking water from there, essentially through politics, right? And a bunch of lying, like so much lying and a little bit of money. And essentially destroyed that farming community over the next several years. And the farmers tried to like literal terrorism kind of stuff, like trying to blow up the aqueduct, this kind of thing. And that continued for a number of years. And then as LA continued to grow, like into the 1920s, 1930s, it needed more and more water. And that's just continued. They have all these water right agreements with Northern California. So like when I was a kid, we would have droughts in quotation marks because they weren't actual droughts. It was that we were sending so much of our water to LA that we were on short water. And you'd see on the news, like the news, of course, was trying to show people in LA watering their lawns while we're supposed to take short showers and like all this kind of stuff. So pretty interesting stuff. And a lot of it is that, you know, the desert was not designed to have that many people living in it.
Right.
What?
So, yeah. Turns out.
I do remember that's when I became conscious, Matt. There was a, I mean, it was like literally like the Paris Hiltons in the world and some other celebrities would talk about it in commercials. That's when I realized that like leaving my water running while I was brushing my teeth was a bad habit, right? So that's when I began turning off my toothbrush while I brush my teeth.
Well, and the movie Chinatown.
Turning off your water.
Chinatown is based around this. Like all the politics underneath what's happening in the movie Chinatown is related to the water war, actually water rights stuff, which is interesting.
Interesting.
And it's a good point too, because we're taught, JR just made the distinction between like bathing water and drinking water. We often might not realize how much water powers electricity, right? Tens of millions of people rely on water for just keeping lights on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I did mention a minute ago this distinction between green water and blue water, which I found interesting.
I don't know anything about that.
Virtual water is a phrase that's been around for like 20 years, and that refers more to that idea of like the foreign investment, right? Of taking water virtually, essentially. But green water refers to rainwater.
Yeah.
And blue water refers to the kind of water that is, I'm so bad at science and I can't find my notes. Blue water is the kind of water that's stored in the aqueducts, in the aquifers, and whatever that is. So, yeah, rainfall called green water is generally considered renewable. About 20% is stored on the land surface. And I'm reading an article, by the way, from Mother Jones. They reposted it as a part of like a climate change series. But it was it's called Foreign Companies Export Virtual Water, but it's actually very smartly written and sensitive, and it's not just about that. But it's this blue water that is really the harder to replenish source of water. So that's what's on the land. It's in underground in aquifers. and used to irrigate crops. So it's much more susceptible to overuse, and it's effectively non-renewable. So, like, Matt, to your point, this isn't new. There's a lot of people who will just, like, kind of dismiss these climate conversations and be like, oh, all of a sudden, like, the ozone's bad. All of a sudden, we're out of water. Like, no, the reason we're finding all these things in Lake Mead, which, by the way, includes, like, ancient ruins and incredible volcanic samples that are, like, known in other parts, but they didn't realize there was, like, these old volcanic eruptions in this part of the country, is because it's been going on for 20-plus years. This is two decades into this drought. And now we're just starting to really see these headlines.
Well, and human beings are really bad at telling dangers that are multi-generational. Like, I'll run from a bear, but if you tell me, like, if you do this three generations, there's going to be 400 bears, I'd be like, what are you talking about? Who cares? And I think that's part of the issue here. So that's why we see things like, Clay, did you see about the hunger stones in Czech Republic?
No.
So, okay, so the water level is falling there as well. And they're finding these stones that have messages on them from, like, you know, hundreds of years ago. And they say things like, if you see this stone, weep. Like, they went through a drought generations ago, centuries ago, actually. And they left messages for us. Like, hey, if you see this, things are bad. Which is really scary and interesting. Yeah.
Well, it's not just that we don't know how to tell or remember. I think the present day stories don't connect the dots very well and remind us that this has actually been a part of our lives for a long time. Mm-hmm. Because I remember this from, like, my childhood when we first moved out to the suburbs and learning that you can't water your garden or your lawn on certain days and certain weeks of the month.
Right.
There was, like, an alternating, and it was because of that. It's that blue water. Right. Mm-hmm. You're taking the municipal water to water things outside. And I wouldn't have known that because before we were living in the city in a three flat and we didn't really have much of a yard. So I remember that. And then when Peter and I moved and bought a home, we kind of laughed at the fact that we would be those neighbors with the brown lawn because we were committed to not. Mm-hmm. Not because we wanted to be environmentally friendly, but we were like, why would we pay money to water the grass?
Because you realize lawns are a scam.
Right. Well, let it go dormant. And with the first rain, it greens up automatically. So I was like, I'm not going to waste my time watering this yard. But there's always been that kind of message in the back of my mind, but never in that was it connected to, like, the world is burning. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. I remember my sister lived in Arizona and Chandler next to Phoenix in the 90s. And that was the first time I even heard that people don't cut their grass. They water their, lawn, like, regular to just even have a lawn. And yeah, that seems like an excessive problem. Which is why there's so many restrictions, right? And that kind of brings in a topic I wanted to ask you guys about. It turns out there's a lot of smart people who have been studying this and talking about it for a really long time. That's one of the reasons we're trying to, find out what the reality is. And so a lot of policy advocates, there's a range of issues that water covers. So on the one hand, what should you be allowed to use groundwater for? How much should you be allowed to use? And you guys could probably guess it's not too far of a jump until somebody says, well, the government's just going to control the water supply. So in parts of the Southwest, there's a lot of people who are like, I don't want my neighbors to suffer, but I certainly don't want the government to control my water, right? So now everything comes down to ideas. Everything comes down to worldviews and philosophies. And JR, I want to ask you about this specifically, but I did not realize, first of all, in recent years, a lot of local and state governments have been voting on just, do we want to put into law, first off, that access to clean water is a human right? So, like, New York voted on it in 2021. This election week coming up here in 2022, there's towns in Wisconsin and Florida that are literally putting that question on the ballot. Like, hey, do we all want to just like acknowledge and put into law that access to clean water is a right? And then there's these other ballot issues that are popping up. And some people are saying no to some of the propositions that are on the ballot. We don't want to let the government have any control. But JR, you kind of mentioned that a minute ago, you know, with this access to clean water. What do you think about water policy and what's actually happening in this crazy political climate?
I mean, it comes back to like what we expect the government to do for us, right? And it's hard to
not do to us.
Yeah, but I mean, you die if you don't get enough water. That's science. And I just think about like even that's going science. Back even going back, like, you know, some of the most famous and well-preserved pieces of archaeological history that we have are aqueducts, right? Governments creating means to bring water places. So when we look at a place like Jackson or Flint, you know, Flint's been getting which it's a little different. Flint and Jackson, it's not that there's not water, it's that it's not safe water and the government's not doing what they need to do to make it safe. But yeah, I mean, unless you are a strict libertarian, which insert your favorite libertarian joke here. My favorite libertarian joke, someone tweeted that libertarians remind them of house cats that are convinced that they're big and bad and scary, but they don't recognize that the only reason they can function the way they do is because everything is provided for them already. And they're convinced that if they could just get outside, they'd be the king of the jungle. But what would actually happen is they'd get hit by a car. So yeah, libertarians. Anyway, unless you're a strict libertarian, which is a foolish position that doesn't actually function in the real
world. Wow, bringing the heat today.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's some libertarians out there.
Love to have you on the show, libertarians.
Great, come on the show, and we will collectively laugh at how ridiculous your position is.
Wow, now you're speaking for us and our feelings about libertarians?
Yeah, I don't endorse this take.
Okay, fine. We can argue about libertarians, then it's stupid. And by stupid, I mean completely unworkable and foolish and only people who have...
Unrealistic.
Yeah, a total lack of grounding in reality can hold that position.
Yeah, I wish we could get you to share your real thoughts.
I know. So, coming in hot.
You know what's... Never mind. I was going to make a butt music joke, but libertarians don't deserve it.
Wow. Did a libertarian hurt you when you were a child? Like, what's wrong there? Man.
No, it's just hilarious. So, well, because in this issue, right, they're like, I should get all the water. Like, government shouldn't control my water.
I wish our listeners could see what JR was just doing on video and his like physical.
I didn't know this about you, JR.
Yeah.
I didn't either.
Oh, yeah. It is the most absurd position you could possibly take. I think it's even more absurd than anarchy.
More absurd than
anarchy
the people
is the best
who think about the lizards have taken over.
Yeah.
Wow.
More absurd in a workable way. Like I would be.
You're a reptilian, aren't you? Tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I would be more interested in the policy suggestions for people who genuinely believe the government is controlled by lizard people than I am policy suggestions from a libertarian.
Well, we're going to have to definitely revisit this one down the line.
Anyway, my point was, unless you're a foolish libertarian, the government has some sort of obligation to provide its citizens with access to safe water. That was my only point.
That was your point.
Sounds like you had another point. Well, I mean, New York has a $4 billion Environmental Bond Act on the ballot. So, of course, a lot of people say, fix it, but don't spend all of this money, right? And that's not $4 billion for water. There's, of course, the Biden infrastructure plan that's going to be in effect for years. And parts of that will affect the water crisis, right? Part of the infrastructure, to your point about Flint and these other issues that are caused by infrastructure that taint water and so on.
I'm going to run on a platform of making everything better without changing anything. It's going to be a huge hit. Huge hit.
Amazing. You know, as a libertarian, I approve of that.
Yeah, I feel like I'm kind of a libertarian who's being attacked right now. I gotta really revisit this. I didn't realize my potential ideology was so fraught.
I'm happy to explain it to you.
Well, anyway, back to water.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, JR. Kathy, a lot of folks are paying attention to the water crisis, like me, really in a new way because of these news stories, these sensational ideas about all the mafia bodies in Lake Mead and so on. And so the logical follow-up this month is, what else might make people pay attention to the global climate crisis? And Matt, there's been plenty of interesting demonstrations recently. I would have thrown it to Kathy, but I think I want to hear Matt first. Talk about what have you seen.
What are you throwing, though?
You know, in our
throw it like soup.
In our private chats, our friends and the four of us and most of our spouses, we've been talking about some of this stuff. And like the complex feelings of seeing younger, mostly younger environmental protesters who are doing things like throwing soup onto famous paintings or super gluing their head to a museum wall or each other. Or putting mashed potatoes on a Van Gogh, or, you know, like this kind of thing. And a lot of our conversation has been about, is that helpful? Is it useful? Is it actually moving the question forward? Is it just stupid? Is it a combination of those things? Like, yeah, all that kind of stuff. And it's, in my opinion, pretty complicated. I don't know that we all agree on that. Anyway, that's what we're headed toward, right? That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. What do you mean, pretty complicated?
I think it's easy, right? The hot takes that most of us have tend to be based on a headline or something or a picture, right? Where it's like, oh, the girl with the pearl earring has been smeared with food, and then you know you get the different. Well, that's just stupid. Or how is that helping the environment? Those sorts of things. Oh, it's harming museums, right? But it's not getting into all the other questions that are wrapped up in it. Like, well, why is no one listening when the protesters are trying other ways of getting conversations started? Is this exactly what they're wanting? Is that these four people will talk about it on their podcast later, you know, that will bring up global issues with the ecology? And then like the whole question of, is it good or bad? It's complex because the question is, what are they actually attempting to do? Is that a good thing to attempt to do? Do we agree with them or disagree? Like, that's what I'm saying about it being complex. There's a lot of different ways you can go with the conversation.
Yeah, I was ready to dismiss it out of hand, you know, as this is stupid. But I realized that that's probably not a very nuanced response and that my friends might have different takes. And so that's why I asked, right? And I got good, educated takes on why it's potentially useful. Kathy, I don't know where you landed on all of this. What have you reflected on when you looked at some of these climate activists and their protest styles?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've landed anywhere. I'm still thinking about... So my initial reaction to this recent wave of protests and actions has been, what a waste of food. So in all seriousness, right? I mean, so we're talking about countries in economic distress, people with, you know, struggling with inflation across the globe, and people struggling to afford food. And so here these activists are throwing and wasting food. So that's my initial reaction. Mm-hmm. And then to hear about what they are trying to bring awareness to and how, I think I'm always asking, so who is your audience for this? Other than for it to get some sort of media attention, who is your audience and what are you hoping your audience is going to do? And I'm still really unclear as to who the audience and the actions that that audience is supposed to take as a result of food being thrown at these pieces of art and people gluing themselves themselves to various walls. Like, I don't know what's supposed to happen next.
Yeah, and Matt, you know, you made the point. It's not the actual art. It's the protective coverings and the messaging is you're upset about
they're not
this.
Damaging the art. Yeah.
Yeah. You're upset about this. Why aren't you more upset about this? Right. Is kind of the
right.
The
which is a weird, right,
but
shamey
it's so
thing.
Over, well, and it's oversimplified. Like, I can still care about this and be, and question your action. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I also don't appreciate is that response of like, oh my gosh, so you care about this old piece of art that doesn't make any impact on your life versus, you know, the climate. And I'm like, well, actually, it's both. I can care about both at the same time. Mm-hmm.
Environmentalists also don't agree, right? There are plenty of environmentalists who think this is a really stupid way to go about things.
Well, in fact, the guy that glued his head to Girl with the Pearl Earring at The Hague last week, they were wearing whatever the shirt they were wearing about stopping the oil company. Mm-hmm. That was an actual organization. The organization's like, this isn't ours. Like, these guys are wearing these shirts, but we didn't actually do this.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I wonder if there's a generational piece here too. Like, I was talking to my Gen Z kids about this, and I was like, does your generation think this is stupid or cool or something else? And they're like, oh, everyone knows it's stupid. But you also got to respect that they're going viral. They're getting the attention. They're getting the conversation started. I was like, well, that's interesting. So I was talking to Allie and I asked her, like, so, okay, how, explain to me, like, what is the positive side of this? And she goes, well, like, in her head, they're trying to reach the most difficult people to reach. So climate deniers, even climate change denial folks. So like someone who regularly watches Fox News, let's say. And she said, so say your grandpa watches Fox News all the time and he doesn't believe in climate change. And you go to his house for Thanksgiving and he goes, did you see these idiots, you know, destroying art? And then suddenly the conversation is open for you to go in and talk to grandpa about the fact that, like, actually, that's not what's happening, grandpa. I was like, well, that's interesting. And that's for my generation. That's not how we approach things. Right. And I think there's even Kathy, you were talking some about how there's generational changes in what actually works in protests, like the difference between, well, we used to have sit-ins, you know, in the 70s, right. And those are still happening rarely, but they're not like a widespread thing. Or Kathy, you were talking about open letters, right? That those have kind of shifted in effectiveness over the years.
Well, because when open letters, when you did an open letter 10, 15 years ago, you couldn't just throw it up on Twitter.
Right.
Right. Or connect people.
We got a million
automatically
million retweets.
Way. Right. Or you know, change.org and spaces like that where you can put up your own petition, your own open letter, and get a bunch of people to sign it without any measurable change.
Right.
At the systemic and organizational level. And having been a part of kind of protests and letters demanding X, Y, and Z, I've also learned that sometimes the result isn't actually what you wanted, right? That the result can come as a knee-jerk reaction. So, like, I was involved in calling a Christian publisher to task about some
racist
publication
book
that they had. Yeah. And there were some conversations and that book was pulled, but did it really change the way Christian publishing happened at that publishing house? Probably not. And the authors of said book went on to go on and live happily ever after.
And write more books,
so,
no doubt. Yeah.
And write, yes. And lead in spaces and talk about leadership. So
they probably talked about racism.
They probably did. Well, they were victims. I mean,
right,
I was
like
definitely
to their audience. They were persecuted.
So you're saying they got canceled
right before it was even a thing. I was the one canceling it. You didn't know, did you? That I that little old me,
Kathy, then, originated.
So I
canceling.
Think about that. So I think about that in terms of the protests that I see. And like, okay, so what actions have I taken? And what was the change that came out of it? Was that the change I intended?
Right.
So, and that's why I'm asking, like, what change is going to happen by throwing soup on a museum?
Well, so yeah, museums are saying maybe we need to start checking people to make sure they don't have food as they're coming in, right? Like, make sure no one has a can of soup with them. So it's like a security issue. So that doesn't push us toward talking about climate change issues or oil or anything else.
Yeah, that was a piece in The Atlantic where the author talked to someone who is involved in these climate conversations and had also been a director of a museum. And he was saying, what I think is, how much more do we have to invest now to protect the art? Do we have to pull it from the public view? How much more security will we need? And, you know, he was talking in all these practical ways that it hurts the public, whereas if you're trying to come against the rich because they own the art, he's like, they don't own the art that's in the museum. Their art is in their private homes, which then that's a whole different slippery slope. If you have somebody who actually does think out a good protest, how many crazy copycatters are going to come along to just like do something insane, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But
and I also don't want to be the person who's like, you're protesting wrong, right? Because I've also been on the end of like, I've been in marches and physical protests and people, you know, why are you stopping traffic? It's an inconvenience. We don't care about that. I just need to get to work on time. And that's not helping your cause. Mm-hmm. So I've been in both spaces and so again, I didn't land anywhere, Clay. I'm still asking those questions on what eventually actually changes with bigger protests, actions.
I do think it's interesting, like, I just have to get it on to work on time. Like, these sorts of things are often the, not just this sort of activity for protesters, but many kinds. There's something, we just have to get to work on time. We're just trying to watch the football game. We're just trying to do this. And it's amazing how often these things are actually tied up in the identity that we get as part of the capitalist system. And I'm not saying I'm not saying that as a critique of capitalism. I'm just saying that's a thing we should probably pay attention to, that over and over, these things keep coming down to questions about money and our role and relationship to money, which is...
Well, and I thought of that a lot, Matt, when I was reading about the water stuff, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
I mean, it all comes down to, we're trying to sell almonds all over Europe. We're trying to have all these products in all of these countries. People are trying to, you know, supply an economy. There's definitely a huge economic component to everything. It's the driving factor.
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
Do you think there are small things, though, that people can be doing that may not make a huge difference individually?
JR?
So I actually wonder, Kathy, if that's the wrong question.
Okay.
Because the reality is mega corporations and the ultra wealthy are actually driving climate change much more than the other 99% of us combined. I mean, it's when you look at all the science, all the numbers, we are not the problem. Certainly that doesn't mean we can't be more responsible. Sure. But if the other 99% of us all turn the water off while we're brushing our teeth and, you know, try to reduce our emissions, the problem will not shift because it's really corporations, governments, and the ultra rich. So actually what I think is interesting here is that what we all really want is like a Staples easy button. Just give us, we will happily invest a weekend. Okay, a Saturday, if you can tell us one thing that we can do to stop this. But that's not how this change happens. And I think the problem, which we've already alluded to in this episode, the problem with things like this, right, is that they're not coupled very intentionally to serious long-term protest. Ibram Kendi, in one of his books, actually distinguished, he called these demonstrations, these kind of like, you know, a march or a, you know, a small contained sort of a thing, a demonstration, And he called the longer organized kind of a thing the protest. So I think the classic example is the Montgomery bus boycott, where, yes, we had Rosa Parks not get up to move. But in addition to that, we had the entire black community of Montgomery, Alabama, plan a months-long protest of not riding the bus, where they organized how to get people to and from their jobs. And they literally built this entire new network that enabled the entire black community to survive without riding the bus so that they could pull all of this back. And it wasn't Rosa Parks refusing to move to the back of the bus that changed everything.
Right.
That's the story that gets told because it's a great story. It was this months long ongoing organized protest. And that's the kind of thing that if we're going to be serious about making a difference, we have to do. And that's why it doesn't get done, because that's really hard. We have to educate ourselves. We have to get creative. We have to commit to be uncomfortable and to build new systems.
Well, I think that's part of it, JR, is that we don't like to be uncomfortable. So even in those little things, that question that I asked is, I think that's part of it because people don't want to be inconvenienced, right? I want to water my lawn whenever I want to water my lawn, never asking the question, why the heck does anybody need grass? Like, it's not native here in the suburbs of Chicago. Like, why do we need to water?
It's entirely a vanity thing. It's we all collectively decided at some point that it was a status symbol, right. When it was actually stupid.
Stupid.
Yeah.
After the war, right? When before the war was the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. Like, what's the opposite of economic poverty and dust? Like, prosperity in a car and a garage and a yard.
And green grass, I guess.
And by the way, you know, no one ever talks about Claudette Colvin. She sat on the bus before Rosa Parks. JR, to your point, like, there were other, you know, demonstrations.
And all of it, by the way, all of it was planned, right? Rosa's demonstration was planned. Like, all of this was planned. Again, I think we get this idea that
got court-martialed when he was still serving in the military for doing a similar thing.
Yeah, we assume that, like, just Rosa Parks got mad one day. Nope.
Yeah.
That's not how it happened.
So it's a good distinction, I think, that one between demonstration and protest. Mm-hmm. Kathy, you know, to your question, and JR, I get it. Like, I might be the most cynical person on this show. I don't know. It's hard to maintain that idealism. I remember when I was young hearing that. And, like, you know, older people become conservative and you lose your idealism and all that. It's interesting to be kind of middle-aged and thinking through how I view, you know, the future, the world after me, and all those things. But certainly, we can get educated, right? I do think there are big, big activist things that are completely useless and some that are not thought out at all. Just as there are some that really do create important conversations and maybe can actually manipulate people who are making the decisions and driving the change. But we can get educated. I watched a documentary this summer, a Nova show called Can We Cool the Earth? And started to learn a little bit. I'm seeing that for a lot of folks who are voting this month, there are going to be local issues. So, like, you got the cattle growers in Arizona who are anti anything that's going to bring in any kind of government control, right? There's associations like this, and they obviously have a vested economic interest and a political philosophy. They still care about their neighbors, but they just think there's a different way to go about it. There is probably a reasonable level of what laws should be driving the 21st century. So in the 1850s, if you got to the Southwest and you staked your claim, you got the land and anything underneath it. You got access to all the water rights. And so now we've got foreign companies and a lot of big American companies that understand that America has 19th century laws. So they buy the land and they get access to things that we didn't even think about 150 years ago, right? These are things that can be legislated and can be updated in reasonable ways that are for the public good improvements. So it always starts with getting educated, right? And finding out where you can have some kind of a say, I think.
Yeah.
So any final thoughts? What
I mean, I just think that part of the problem is that our entire infrastructure is built the wrong way to deal with this, and that the actual solution requires a radical rebuilding of our infrastructure, our culture, a variety of things. And that's, it's not something that's done in a day, and it's not easy. And it's going to be a difficult, it's going to be a fight to get there. And some people don't want to change because they don't believe that this or that thing is true. And some of those people don't believe it's true because people who have a vested interest in the current setup are pushing to keep it this way. And that's going to do real harm to people. That's the end result.
Well, on that happy note.
But you know what I found has the answers to these questions?
What?
Libertarianism.
I was thinking pop culture. So I'm wondering,
how can we think about something
fascinated
else
by?
Help us to feel good.
Distract us.
The industry, my friends, that was a revolution.
To distract us or to spark our imagination.
Yes.
For
yes,
better you. Things to
escapism
come.
Is the answer.
Agreed.
What are you guys escaping into this week?
Well, I was going to share a film that delighted me from my bad movie birthday. However,
what? You're not supposed to get any enjoyment out of that.
I know, but this one was so bad it was glorious. instead of that, though, I'm going to recommend a nonfiction book called A Libertarian Walked Into a Bear.
oh, man. I read an article about this book. It sounds hilarious.
An investigative journalist found out about there was this one county in New Hampshire that had more bear attacks on humans per capita than any other county in the United States. So he decided to investigate why. And what he discovered was that a bunch of libertarians had decided to take over a town in New Hampshire, like all move there and then all vote themselves into office and then dismantle the government so they could have a utopian paradise of libertarians. And guess what? It didn't work. So then when bears came into town, there was no infrastructure to deal with the bears, and they started attacking people. The end.
Spoiler.
The book is great.
Spoiler alert.
The journalist actually does a relatively good job of hiding his complete and total disdain for libertarians, with the exception of a few sentences here and there.
The author's name? J.R. Forrester.
Let me look it up. No, it's not.
While you're looking that up, Matt, what are you fascinated by this week?
I am reading a novel called The Golden Enclaves by Naomi Novik, which JR first told me to read. This is the third book in a trilogy, called, Scholomance, right, JR?
Correct.
So it's, imagine Hunger Games meets Harry Potter, let's say. That's probably close. It's really delightful. The third book picks up with the main character you've been following throughout in really the hardest place she's been yet. And it is really fun and funny. And the main character is kind of like, imagine if Draco Malfoy and Harry Potter wanted to be good, but he knows he could be evil at any moment if he takes the wrong step. This is this girl. She's incredibly powerful, but also borderline, you know, she's right on the border of good and evil. So it's really, really fun, and it's funny, and it's a quick, easy read. So I started reading it.
Sounds like female JR.
Last night, and I'm halfway through maybe. It's really fun. So
I would also say,
what's the first one called, JR?
The Scholomance.
The Scholomance. And the second one's The Last Graduate.
Graduates.
Graduates. Last Graduates. Yeah. And then The Golden Enclaves.
I would also say thematically, it has some. It has some parallels to another book very well known to our listeners, which is The Story King. So,
yeah, I could see that. Maybe that's why I like it so much. How about you, Kathy? What are you into right now?
Okay, so I'm the resident trash TV.
Yep,
expert, it's true. It is. So I binge through Bling Empire season 3.
Bling Empire? Is that what you said?
Bling Empire, yes. And I know I mentioned this on the show in previous episodes. So it follows this group of Asian Americans out in the West Coast, they're just filthy rich. Filthy rich.
Nice.
And it's just so over the top. But there's something about it that is so compelling. One, because it kind of breaks this kind of model minority stereotype. They're just, I don't know what these people do that they made so much money. Some of them haven't done a lot. Their families are rich. But this season in particular, there's a lot of like relationship drama. And then there is a lot of kind of identity formation stuff for Asian Americans. And I just found that part fascinating and a reminder, one, money doesn't solve anything. Mm. It actually can cause a lot of problems.
It's true.
And mask a lot. And then there's this underlying theme of money and power and ease in life that I feel like resonates with my experience in evangelicalism. Mm. And the lure to kind of these, popular evangelical people who live kind of more fancy lives online, and how maybe that's all of a mask. I don't know. What? So anyway, Bling Empire on Netflix.
Wow.
Well, how about you, Clay? I probably won't be checking that out.
Come on.
Because it's just not my jam.
Oh,
he's
man.
He's too busy with Love is Blind Dallas, Kathy.
Oh, my gosh. Can we not with Love is Blind, you guys?
I watched that.
I am busy with a new show on Netflix called Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities. Is it on any of your radars?
That's actually a sequel to the Bling radar. Empire.
No, it's not. Oh, it's not at all. Heard of it? Watched it?
We've seen the first two episodes. It's great.
I have heard of it, and that is all.
It is a modern take. So back in the day, before me, Hitchcock had Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Right.
And
probably a lot of our favorite creators of today were influenced by some of those episodes back in the day. Kind of like a really suspenseful, dark twist on the Twilight Zone vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tales from the Crypt in the 90s on HBO was a similar kind of thing. This is the latest styling in such a show where short stories are told, probably 1 hour shorts. And Del Toro presents the episode, and then it goes into it. They are made at the highest quality and at the darkest reality. I mean, the special effects and whatever you could think of is realistic. And that first episode, JR, you saw, Lot 36, was, I think, written or directed, or maybe both, by Del Toro. And that had Timothy Blake Nelson from one of JR's favorite movies. What is it?
The Incredible Hulk, starring Eric Bana.
Oh, I mean, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, yeah, that one.
We watched. Okay, so JR, I don't know if you've gotten to The Autopsy.
Not yet. Nope, that's next.
David Goyer actually did the teleplay. Wow. I mean, you definitely will not be okay after that episode ever again. And last night we watched The Outside. So we're about four in. And The Outside has Kate Micucci, and I think his name is Martin Starr from Silicon Valley and Spider-Man.
That's funny.
Just like, it's kind of like Black Mirror, but for whatever reason, I didn't have the mental resistance, like the emotional fear. So I just started watching these, and wow.
Clay, have you seen Creepshow?
The movie? 1982?
Or the series? Any of them?
Yeah, the original movie.
This has most Creepshow vibes to me because they're funny in addition to being scary for the most part. And also a lot of practical effects. So like really, it feels really, at least the two I've seen so far,
very much practical effects, definitely some humor, but then there's The Autopsy also, which is not very funny or fun.
But yeah, Creepshow is the vibe I've gotten so far. We love it. Obviously, Del Toro is a lot of fun. So
a young Ted Danson is in the original movie, and Leslie Nielsen too.
So Bling Empire, by the way, that's on Netflix.
Bling Empire.
Yeah.
Libertarian walks into a bear.
Yes.
The subtitle is The Utopian Plot to Liberate an American Town and Some Bears, by Matthew Hongols Hetling.
Get him on the show.
It'd be super fun. What do y'all have going on this week? Anywhere you want to point some folks?
I want to send everyone to make sure they are registered and go vote. Go vote early, or if your municipality does vote by mail, all that kind of stuff, because this show will drop on Monday, and I will go to bed very early so that I can be an election judge at my polling place at 5 a.m. Tuesday morning.
Here in Washington, we all vote by mail. I've already voted, and my vote has been accepted.
Nice.
Fake voting.
Yep. Guys, I have a podcast called The Fascinating Podcast. I think you'll really enjoy it. I've been on a number of episodes of it.
Great.
As a guest.
Yes.
Yes.
My Halloween article is officially up at Tor. It looks back at the new Halloween trilogy and kind of compares it to the original and asks why they turned Michael Myers into a Christ figure in the last one.
Very strange and excellent article.
Thank you.
I still have never watched any single Halloween movie all the way through.
Missing out, bud. Missing out.
I have not seen just a making full Halloween
movie. Why have they not stopped? Why didn't they stop like 20 years ago?
Are there?
Seven.
It doesn't even matter.
Okay, listen. Hang on. Okay, so there were, I think, six kind of that held together. Then Rob Zombie did a reboot and did two. And then David Gordon Green did three movies. The first one came out in 2018, but they pretended none of them after the first one existed. So Halloween 1 plus his new three are like a tetralogy of films, but there are several different kind of incarnations of stuff. But I think altogether there are 13 of them.
That's ridiculous.
And Jamie Lee Curtis played an older Laurie Strode in two different like parallel universes of them.
Anyway. So guess what? This will not be the best Jamie Lee Curtis movie this year. Guaranteed.
Guaranteed. Yeah, that's true. So,
but this has been episode 339. We'll be back next week, probably talking about whatever this crazy nation does in the elections. And when that all gets to be too much in a couple weeks, JR is going to bring us a wonderful show all about butts, which I'm looking forward to.
Thanks, folks. Stay safe out there. Oh, I should have saved the butt music for the butt episode.
Well, there's still time.
Well, I tried to negotiate, but I was told it was non-negotiable.
Yep, you did. Yep.
That stinks.
And with that, the end.